So here's a poem. Here's a poem about cancer. I have been living with cancer myself for a number of years, although this poem is not about me. It's about a kind of cancer that I don't have. But I wrote it at a time when I was going through treatment. It's called The Mole, and the title changes meanings during the poem. One thing that might be helpful is about midway through, several things are mentioned that are kind of going to teach you, and the Four North Fracture Zone are a geological formation and a constellation, and they're simply in this list of things that flash through this man's mind as he's going through various treatments and losing his mind. After love discovers it, the little burn or birthmark in an odd spot he can neither see nor reach. After the internist's downturned mouth, specialists leaning over him like diviners, machines reading his billion cells. After the onslaught of insight, cures crawling through him like infestations, so many surgeries a wrong move leaves him leaking like overripe fruit. After the mountain aster and ice wine, Michigan football, Canis Vinatici, and the Four North Fracture Zone shrink to a room where voices grow hushed as if at some holy place, and even in the kindest eye there lurks the eternity to which he's been commended. After speech, touch, even the instinct to eat are gone, and he has become nothing but a collection of quiet ticks and twitches as if something wanted out of his riddled bones, the carious maze of his brain, as the last day glaciers into his room, glass and chrome so infinitesimally faceted it seems he lives inside a diamond. He breaks into a wide smile, as if joy were the animal in him, blind, scrabbling, earth-covered creature tunneling up from God knows where to stand upright, feasting on distances, gazing dead into the sun.
The Mole is an astonishingly clear portrait of a kind of cancer. I was surprised to hear you say it is not about your cancer, though.
Yeah, this is about a person who has skin cancer. You know, it was discovered in a mole, and I have a blood cancer. During the time that I've had treatment, which has been years now, I've certainly met people with all kinds of different cancers, and this was about no person in particular, actually. It was a sort of constellation of various things that were happening to me and impressions I was having when I was going through treatment. But it's not about me. And it is, in a way. I mean, I think we wait for some time in our life when we're going to be happy or going to have joy, and as if it descends upon us. But in fact, I think we have to practice these things, and poetry, and sometimes for me, is a way of practicing this. This poem is a poem about joy breaking into this guy's life in a very miraculous way, and it being sort of the seed of his whole existence. For me, though, the act of writing it is very much an act of practicing that.
Actually searching for the joy that you hope will eventually come out of your experience, too.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah,
you've written that that all the while you've been writing, even before you knew about the cancer, you've seen your work as marked by a kind of existential anxiety. Did that become even more true once you got the diagnosis of blood cancer?
Well, I think it made me see my work in a different way. I think. You know, for years, I would say what I saw as a kind of wall at the end of everything, at the end of every experience, an absolute end to everything. And, you know, death is the extreme of that. But then every experience we have in some ways is marked by its end. And there's an elegy contained in every instant. And And for years, that's all I could see. And I think when I got the diagnosis, paradoxically, you would think that that would throw me into a kind of absolute despair. And in fact, it did for a little bit. But the overall effect was a ventilation of my life. And I began to be able to see through that wall or to have moments when it seemed like the wall wasn't there. And I don't know how else to talk about it except in this sort of metaphorical language. But that was the effect.
Well, you had a kind of parallel experience, it seems to me, with your faith as well. You say, if I understood it correctly, you've had faith all your life. This is not a question. There was a time, though, when you sort of let it survive on its own, didn't need your direct involvement. A lot of people getting a diagnosis of cancer would send them burrowing into their faith. But instead, it seemed to have... Well, it seemed to me that you kind of found the joy in it again.
I think so. I think the way I phrase it to myself is that at some point in the last few years, I assented to a faith that was latent within me and had long been dormant. And because it was dormant, I think I was in despair a lot of the time. And you know, it can take some real jolts to get us to out of the ruts of our lives. I mean, it's hard to change your coffee consumption. I mean, imagine how hard it is to change your faith or to change, you know, these huge directions in which we're living. And people mock the idea of an illness causing great change in a person, but it seems to me perfectly natural that it takes these jolts to make us see our lives. It's too bad that it does, and I think some very great souls are probably capable of making changes without it. But it took a huge change for me, and the change did jolt me into, I don't mean to minimize the despair, but it did jolt me into ways of dealing with despair.
You know, I don't think anybody who hasn't been through it can understand how much of a shock that moment must be. When you have to face up to your own mortality, it's not as though you got a date saying, "Okay, today you're here and tomorrow you won't be." But the end came closer, and became more real to you. And some people would be tempted at that point to look for some kind of romance in death. And I don't get the impression that you've done that. You don't romanticize either your mortality or your faith.
Well, it doesn't seem romantic. It seems, I mean, I really, really don't want to die. I love my life. I have two daughters. My wife, I love very much. I mean, I have a wonderful life, and I see no romance in death. It's very easy to romanticize death when you're young, and I did it like so many other artists. There's a famous line from Wallace Stevens, "Death is the mother of beauty," that people quote all the time, meaning that, you know, that death, a clear-eyed look at death enables us to have a clear-eyed look at life. It intensifies our perception. It's the old carpe diem cry. And
is that true?
No, it's not true. No, it's not true. It's a load of crap, actually. But, I mean, Stevens is a great poet, and that's a great poem that poem comes from, Sunday Morning. It's one of my favorite poems, but it's a poem that could only have been written by someone for whom death was a complete abstraction. And once it's not an abstraction... you can't say that anymore. You can't say death is the mother of beauty. In fact, it's the annihilation of beauty. And you have to find some other way of finding a future. And I think we can't live without some kind of... We are always projecting ourselves forward and backward in our lives, and we can't live without some kind of a past and future.
I suppose one of the good things then is that having cancer has made writing about death not only something you desire but something you must do.
Yeah, I'm always hesitant to attribute any good thing to cancer, but because there's nothing good about it actually. But yes, it is true that I have. Developed in a way that I may not have otherwise. You know, people ask me all the time about this poet I've just translated, Osip Mandelstam, whether He was tormented to death by Stalin and died when he was 47, and he sort of drove Stalin insane. And people ask me if he was made the poet he was by what happened to him, and my answer is the events probably accelerated his development and maybe skewed it in a certain direction, but it did not make him the poet he was. He was already a very great poet and a poet of incredible existential intensity, and he would have been that poet no matter what. And what happened to him inflects the way that we read him, but it didn't make him.
Although it does introduce you to some thoughts that you probably would not have had without it.
Probably. Although, you know, these things are going to happen to everybody eventually. Yeah. It just happened to me earlier than I would have liked.
There's a starkness, though. There's a poem I wonder if you would read for us. It's called It Is Good to Sit, Even in a Rotting Body. It's
sure.
On page 88 of Every Riven Thing. If you could tell me a little bit about it, that would be great.
I wrote several poems after I got diagnosed. I had not written poems for about 3 years. It had been a long silence and a very miserable silence, and I was desperate within that silence. After I got the diagnosis, I was jolted enough to begin writing again, not immediately, but relatively soon, a few months after that. And I wrote several poems that seemed to me expressions of very gratifying expressions of faith, not a traditional kind of faith, but a faith that I could understand and hold on to. And then as time went on, I wrote poems that seemed to refute that. They seemed to directly refute the gains that I had made and to expunge all idea of God from the poems, all idea of a heaven from the poems, and to actually ridicule the notion sometimes. And I was very confused by this for a while and disturbed by it, because you can't really control the poems that you're writing. But then I began to think of, I read some things. I read Dietrich Bonhoeffer's, and he said once that the God we serve calls us to live in a world without God. Before God and with God, we stand without God. And it's a paradoxical statement, but a helpful statement to me at the time. And I began to think that maybe the same impulse that led me to sing of God at one time might lead me to sing of godlessness at another, and that sometimes God might actually call us to unbelief, or what looks like unbelief, in order that faith can take new forms in our lives and in life in general. And this is one of those poems that I wrote at the time that very much confused me. It is good to sit, even a rotting body, in sunlight, uncompromised by God or lack of God, to see the bee beyond all the plundered flowers, air stagger toward you, and like a delicate helicopter hover above your knee until it finds you to be not sweet, but at least not flinching, its hair legs on the hair of your leg, silvering a coolness through you like a soul of nerve.
I love that phrase, in sunlight uncompromised by God or lack of God. It's a purer form of sunlight, isn't it?
Yeah, it's some way of getting at a moment without wanting there to be a beyond, experiencing our lives without needing some beyond that moment that we're in.
We shouldn't make it sound as though all of the poems in Every Riven Thing are all about cancer or all about God, for that matter. They range all over from playfulness, from remembrance to love, to mourning, to praising God, to railing against death. Do those experiences that have come to you from your diagnosis and treatment, have they come to make life seem more whole or part of a whole somehow?
Sometimes. But sometimes I'm just like everyone else. I think you slip back. I mean, one of the great shocks of a shocking thing happening to you is how easily you slip back into your old life. And I think at times I do slip back into the same person that I was. We don't change utterly, ever. And I think there's disappointment in that. Also sometimes kind of a relief in that. But there is no doubt that the intensity of the events that have happened to me, and particularly in the last year, I've had a bone marrow transplant and came close to dying twice in the last year. They've had a profound effect upon me and the way that I see my life. But I very much have to practice joy, practice happiness. I mean, you have to, it's like exercise. I don't think these things just come to you.
I was thinking while reading your poetry about what it is about poetry that seems so important to us when it comes time to think about life and death. I mean, I remember when my mother died, I read poetry. Dennis O'Driscoll, in fact. And when my father died, I read Billy Collins, which seemed more like him. But there are all of these things, and it seems to me that we all seem to turn to this precision of language for some kind of comfort or explanation when faced with these big moments in our lives.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's two reasons for that. One is that poetry, I mean, the most obvious is that poetry can simply articulate emotions and sensations that we're having and which we cannot grasp for ourselves, particularly in moments of extremity, and poetry can articulate them for us and sort of give us a way of holding it up outside of ourselves and looking at it and coming to understand it. But another thing that it can do is, in which it does with its music and its forms, and is it can cause these slippages in consciousness where you can seem to see through the reality of things, or what seems to you the reality of things in ordinary moments, and you can perceive shadows and transparencies and angularities that you never would have perceived before. And that all happens in the same way that say, listening to music does those things. It's another way of making those things happen. And I think so poetry has that dual ability to actually speak the words that we need and then to give us the sounds that cause us to almost to be able to slip free of language at times and experience things beyond language.
And sometimes, of course, death is just something on the edges of a poem. It's not per se the thing the poem is about at all.
Exactly.
Maybe it hovers there. One of our producers said about your poem, Five Houses Down, she said it helped her understand more the experience of being a boy than any novel she's ever read. Well, it's not a poem about death. It's a poem about a unique man and boy relationship.
Right, and this one actually is rooted in my life. Some things poets make up. This one has made up things in it, but it's actually very real. So this poem, Five Houses Down, was written about a man who lived, in fact, I don't remember if it was Five Houses Down, but that's the way the poem announced itself to me.
It is now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is now. And I used to work for him in various ways up through the years, and this poem emerged out of those experiences. There's nothing you need to know other than I grew up in a very small town in West Texas, Snyder, Texas. And the poem uses the word sapper, which is someone who goes out and diffuses bombs. I loved his tin, demented chickens and the hell-eyed dog, the mailbox shaped like a huge green gun. I loved the eyesore opulence of his five partial cars, the wonder-cluttered porch with its oil-spill plumage, tools called in oil, the dark clockwork of disassembled engines, christened sweet baby and benedicted old bitch. and down the steps into the yard the explosion of mismatched parts and black scraps amid which, like a bad sapper cloaked in luck, he would look up stunned, patting the gut that slopped out of his undershirt and saying, "Son, you looking to make some scratch?" All afternoon we'd pile the flatbed high with stacks of Exxon floor mats mysteriously stenciled with his name, rain-rotted sheetrock or miles of misfitted pipes, coil after coil of rusted fence wire that stained for days every crease of me, rollicking it all to the dump where, while he called every ragman and ravined junk dog by name, he cat-picked the avalanche of trash and fished some always fixable thing up from the depths. His endless, aimless work was not work, my father said. His bark like earthquake curses were not curses, for he could goddamn a slipped wrench and shit fuck a stuck latch, but one bad word from me made his whole being twang like a nail misstruck. Ain't no call for that, son. No call at all. Slip knot, what knot, knot from which no man escapes, prestoed back to plain old rope. Whip snake, black snake, deep in the worm dirt, worms like the clutch of mud. I wanted to live forever, five houses down in the womanless rooms a woman sometimes seemed to move through, leaving him twisting a hand-stitched dish towel or idly wiping the volcanic dust. It was heaven to me, beans and weenies from paper plates, black-fingered tinkerings on the back stoop as the sun set on an upturned fruit crate, a little jam jar of rye like ancient light, from which, once, I took a single secret sip, my eyes tearing and my throat on fire.
It's an interesting kind of reality that... Maybe a long time ago, but it's still here now, isn't it?
Yeah, and I was struck reading it, thinking about what you said about death shadowing, even experiences that don't seem to be about it. And this one has slip knot, what knot, knot from which no man escapes, which is obviously some sort of reference to death, the knot from which no man escapes. And this man had the ability to presto it back to plain old rope. And so there's some sort of magical element in poems sometimes, which is no doubt why we seek them out, that enables us to both recognize that knot, that tight knot of mortality, and then to slip free of it for a moment.
Does that happen to you often? Do you find yourself visiting a poem you've written and discovering it said more than you knew?
You know, I never look back, to tell you the truth. It happens in a moment like this when someone is asking me questions about it and I'm reading it, but I never look back at what I've read, what I've written, prose or poetry.
You've written that you stopped writing for a few years. We talked about this. And then you fell in love. And then you were diagnosed with cancer. And then you started writing again. Was that a necessary progression?
Oh, you know, things look necessary in hindsight. We all need to see some sort of coherence to our lives. I think something dramatic had to happen to jolt me out of that silence and also to jolt me out of despair, because it wasn't actually the cancer that turned me or released me to begin thinking of ideas of faith. It was falling in love. The cancer made me need to give a more concrete form to what I was feeling. And so we started going to church, but we were certainly praying together and acknowledging these impulses within both of us before that.
Well, it's easier to search for joy if you think that love brought you back to faith rather than impending death.
Right. There's a wonderful quote from the French thinker, philosopher, writer Simone Weil, that it's necessary to have a supernatural experience of joy before you can have a supernatural experience of suffering, or understand a supernatural experience of suffering. It was true for me that the joy came first for me. I don't know if it's true for everyone, but it's an interesting thought.
Mm. Wonder if you'd read one or maybe two more poems. "And I Said to My Soul, Be Loud." What a nice title that is.
Okay.
Did you find it?
Yeah, found it. Yeah, so this poem, the title is taking off from a line of T.S. Eliot, "And I Said to My Soul, Be Still." To hope would be to hope for the wrong things. It's from Four Quartets, so I'm forgetting the section of Four Quartets. And it was written out of a kind of frustration that I think we probably all feel sometimes, where we're just down in the dumps and can't drag ourselves out of it, and day after day goes by with the kind of feeling of useless torpor in ourselves that we project out onto the world. And this poem came out of that. "And I said to my soul, be loud. Madden me back to an afternoon I carry in me, not like a wound, but like a will against a wound. Give me again enough man to be the child choosing my own annihilations, to make of this severed limb a wand to conjure, a weapon to shatter dark matter of the dirt dauber's nests, galaxies of glass, whacking glints, bash dancing on the cellar's fire. I am the sound the sun would make if the sun could make a sound, and the gasp of rot stabbed from the compost's lumpen living death is me. Oh, my life, my war in a jar, I shake you and shake you, and may the best ant win, for I am come a whirlwind of wasted things, and I will ride this tantrum back to God until my fixed self, my fluorescent self, my grief-nibbling, unbewildered, wall-to-wall self withers in me like a salted slug." You can tell how my childhood was spent, you know, salting slugs and making ants fight in jars. And
takes me back to the sidewalks in central Illinois, to be honest with you.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is there one you would like to read from this collection?
This poem for my wife, For D, I like. This,
good.
This is for her. Here's a little poem called For D, and D is my wife. "Groans going all the way up a young tree, half cracked and caught in the crook of another. Pause. All around the hill-ringed, heavened pond, leaves shush themselves like an audience. A cellular stillness, as of some huge attention bearing down. May I hold your hand? A clutch of mayflies banqueting on oblivion writhes above the water like visible light."
Thank you.
I sometimes think of love as this energy that always wants to be more than the dimensions in which it's enclosed between two people, and not just the love of not just romantic love, but all kinds of love. And that's very much for me a poem that that showed me this one time, because it's that moment after I say, "May I hold your hand?" There's that vision that becomes available of those mayflies banqueting on oblivion, having their one instant. But it wouldn't have been available without the other person there.